Okay, then. So we've been, those of us who are regulars, have been making our way through the book of 1 Samuel for quite some time. And here in 2 Samuel, the story carries on with that of David. And it's left the battle that we looked at last week far away. It happens in a different part, up near Mount Gilboa, where David's in Ziklag, so a completely different place. Now, we've heard the news about what happened. Well, if you were here last week. And if not, you can see the gist of it. It does get recapped here in this chapter anyway. So we've heard the news before of this tragic defeat in battle when Saul is killed. But for David, he hasn't heard the news. Actually, he's had a battle of his own with the Amalekites. He goes back to base in Ziklag, and there a man arrives. In the first couple of verses, verse 1 and 2, a man arrives, bows down to David. And David asks, "Where are you from?" He says, "I've come from the Israelite camp." He's come to David. You might wonder why. Why did this man make this big trek to come to David? Did he know David was going to be the promised king? Anyway, he gives the report as David's on tenterhooks. Last David knew, of course, of it, he'd marched with the Philistines, hadn't he, towards the borders of Israel before the Philistines sent him back to Ziklag. David wants to know what's happened. And so he asks, and the man says in verse 4, "The people fled from the battle. Many of the people are fallen and dead, and Saul and Jonathan, his son, are dead also." There's the report, just told matter-of-factly, very briefly. It was a defeat. It was a rout. Many people have died. Saul and Jonathan are dead. David wants to be sure, to hear this horrible news, this heartbreaking news. He asks, how can you know this? How can you be sure about this? And the man says in verse 6, "I was there. I was there. I happened to be by chance on Mount Gilboa and saw it happened. I saw Saul retreating perhaps from the chariots and horsemen that were following. And Saul spotted this man." And in verse 7, Saul said, "You know, who are you?" He said, "I'm Amalekite." Verse 8, "And Saul said to me, 'Please stand over me and kill me, for anguish has come upon me, but my life remains in me.' So I stood over him and killed him, and I took the crown that was on his head and the bracelet that was on his arm, and I brought them here to you, my Lord." And David hears these things. David mourns, but more on that in a moment. The thing we see David doing or carrying on with this story is the promised king brings justice. Initially, David mourns. He mourns in verse 11, "And all the men with him, they tear their clothes, they mourn and they fast the whole day for Saul and his Jonathan, the people of the Lord and the house of Israel." They mourn for this tragedy that's happened. But we'll come back to that more in a moment. That carries on in verse 17. The story then doubles back to this young man who had brought the news. Now, if you were here last week, we've already heard a story that was given in the last chapter of 1 Samuel, 1 Samuel 31. And the writer of Samuel told us what happened in this tragic battle. This story, if you've heard both of them, and you put both of them side by side, is a bit different. Of course, we've got an advantage because David hasn't heard the other story. David just hears this news from this man. If you've heard both, well, of course, we know which one to believe. We know to believe the one that's been written down by the historian, by the writer of 1 Samuel. Here we hear a story from the Amalekite. Of course, you should take that with a pinch of salt, shouldn't you? If you know much about the Amalekites. This story is a bit different. In the 1 Samuel chapter 31... Saul asked, when the battle was going badly, defeat was imminent, Saul asked his armor bearer to kill him. The armor bearer's too frightened to do it, and so Saul kills himself. That's what happens in 1 Samuel 31. Here in 2 Samuel chapter 1, this man claims to be there, and Saul asked him to kill him, and he did. Now, we might assume from that this man has sort of inserted himself in the story, presumably to win some favours with David. Perhaps it's more likely that he had come perhaps to raid the bodies of people who'd fallen, and he found the crown and the bracelets and decided that there he had a chance to win for himself some fame and prestige. And so he took the crown and the bracelet and a rather cobbled together story and brought them to David. It seems a little far-fetched, some of the things that happen in his story. What man who has nothing to do with a war just happens to be on a mountain in the middle of a battle where the whole fighting is centered? You tend not to just wander in there if you can help it. And if Saul really is there and has no one alive in the entire army he can turn to, but has to turn to this foreigner whom Saul really doesn't like, it seems a bit far-fetched. And here he is with his story. But of course, as we say, David hasn't heard this other bit of the story. He's just got this account that the man has given. And so David comes back to him in verse 13. Where are you from? We had mentioned he was an Amalekite before. And he replies, I'm the son of an alien, an Amalekite. That's slightly different, he says this time. I'm the son. And that was quite an official term, alien. Don't think agree, men. When he says, I'm the son of an alien, that's kind of a word a bit like immigrant. I don't mean any stigma attached to that. It was just literally a fact. He was not a native-born Israelite. No, his father had probably come to the country as an immigrant from being an Amalekite and come to the land of Israel, but had then taken up residency. So this was quite a technical word. You'll find it mentioned in the books of Exodus and Deuteronomy, how they're meant to treat these aliens. And these are people who are not just passing through the country. These are people who've come to live amongst the Israelites. And so, presumably, that's what his father's done. And then he's a second-generation immigrant, we might say, who's taken up residency in the land of Israel. Now, that changes things slightly, as David is talking to him. Someone who had taken up sort of residential status in Israel, even coming from another country, came under the law. They had various protections. They also came under justice. And that works both ways. That's why David then carries on in verse 14. How was it you were not afraid to put forth your hand and destroy the Lord's anointed? Once he's said this, he's not just saying happened to pass through the land of Israel and happened to be standing there on the mountain. He says, no, I've been here for a while. In fact, my parents have come here. We live in the land of Israel as immigrants, as residents here. And David then turns around to him, how dare you then kill the Lord's anointed? If you've lived here a while, you knew who he was. If you've lived here a while, you know that's unlawful. And so he's just confessed to murdering the king. It's an interesting phrase that David uses, of course. Why? How was it you were not afraid to put forth your hand and destroy the Lord's anointed? Because that's exactly the same phrase that David uses about himself to say that why he wouldn't do it. Back in 1 Samuel chapter 26, when David has an opportunity that seems to be a convenient moment to kill Saul, David says this in reply, do not kill him, do not destroy him. Who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be guiltless? The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. David wouldn't do it when he'd had a seemingly opportunity to do it. But here, this man says he has killed the Lord's anointed. Now, we might think, as we've pointed, there's probably a few holes in his story, and we've heard the other version, so we probably think he probably didn't do it. He probably had just raided the bodies and brought the crown and bracelet. But David doesn't know that. And this man has stood before David and confessed to murdering the king. And so, the new king, the promised king, brings justice. He has to. This man's just confessed to killing the king. He has to be to have the punishment for that. And so David says to one of his young men, go and execute him. And he struck him, so he died. And David said, your blood is on your own head, for your own mouth has testified, saying, I have killed the Lord's anointed. David has to do it. If you think about it the opposite way round, if David spared this man, or if David rewarded him for bringing the crown and bracelet, which is probably what he was hoping, how would David have looked? If the new king has a messenger coming with the crown and bracelet who says, I just murdered the old king. If David lets him go free or lets him go with a reward, he looks like he arranged it, didn't he? He looks like he put out the hit on King Saul. And how does that begin David's time as being king? Looks like it's off to a very bad start, doesn't it? So David has to do the just thing. He has to be the promised king who's going to uphold righteousness and justice. And so he comes. As we think of this promised king, of course, a lot of the things that happen in David's life make us think forward to David's son, Jesus. And when King Jesus comes, well, in the Gospels, we find him bringing righteousness and justice. He doesn't beat about the bush. He'll tell people what is wrong with things. He'll point out the errors of the scribes and Pharisees. He'll go into the temple and say, look, you've turned this place of prayer into a marketplace and a den of thieves. He's the king who brings justice, who has to say, look, there's a break with the old and wrong things that have been done. And this is what God would have us do. The promised king brings justice. Second thing we notice in this passage is the promised king also mourns. As we said, this man brings this news. It's the first David's heard about this report for battle. And in verse 11 and 12, they mourn for the whole day. They mourn. Of course, if you were to have turned the tables on that, if David had died and a messenger had gone and told Saul, we can imagine what Saul would have done. Saul would have been glad. Saul would have gloated, wouldn't he? We can well imagine Saul being pleased if he had news that David was dead. But when David hears news that Saul is dead, he doesn't gloat. He doesn't respond at anything like that. And then in verses 17 through to 27, David composes a song, a lament, a sad song with which he grieves, and he wants other people to be taught it, to grieve about what has happened. And so it is. Even though, in another sense as well, what happened to Saul was God's judgment. We could say he deserved it. He rejected God, and God said he was going to reject Saul as king. And so it's happened. But there's no matter-of-factness about it for David. Even though it was God's judgment, and so it was the right thing that God did. Here David looks at the sadness of the whole situation. There's no rejoicing. There's only tears. Again, it might make you think of Jesus, the promised king who mourns. And when he is on his way and sees the city of Jerusalem in front of him, and he talks of God's judgment that's going to fall on Jerusalem because they will reject him, he weeps. He weeps over Jerusalem. Even though God's justice would be the right thing to happen, Jesus the King mourns for the sadness of it all. And David in his song speaks as if he could to the people of Gath and the streets of Ascalon, the Philistines. Verse 20. He asks them not to rejoice, which of course they had already in the verses of the last chapter. He doesn't want the uncircumcised to rejoice. And of course, what he's implying is what we've already had in the previous chapter, that when this victory happened for the Philistines, they did rejoice, and they proclaimed their victory in their temples, because it looks to all intents and purposes that their idols have won and Yahweh has lost. And David says, no, 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 the uncircumcised shouldn't rejoice. They're wrong on that count. They've misunderstood what's happening. They shouldn't rejoice. He weeps over the situation. The beauty of Israel is dead. Dead on the heights, Mount Gilboa, and so on. David speaks to Mount Gilboa in verse 21, saying that because of the tragedy that happened there on the mountain, oh, there should never be rain on it again. It should be barren. It should be cursed, effectively, for the tragic things that happened there. Again, it's not within David's power to do these things. These are sort of expressions of how gut-wrenching the whole thing is, the grief that he's experiencing. And that's a thing we see here in these verses. It's okay to mourn. It's okay for us to pour out our hearts. And sometimes, perhaps as Christians, we can be perhaps too quick to bring in the silver lining on things, or a deeper hope we might have when something tragic happens, when there is loss of life or whatever it might be, some difficult situations come. We as Christians know there's a reason God's allowed that to happen, and there may be something silver in the lining of it and so on. But as Christians, we shouldn't too quickly get to the quick fix. We are allowed to mourn. And David does that here. He looks at this situation, and in this moment he says, the beauty of Israel is dead. This is a disaster. This is awful. The Philistines are rejoicing. They think their idols have won. The king is dead. His son is dead. The nation is suffering. Many people, David just looks around and says, this is awful. This is a tragedy. He weeps. He mourns. We're allowed to acknowledge the sadness of things, the tragedy of things. There's allowed to be that moment when we just say, no, 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 it's bleak in this moment. We mustn't stay there indefinitely, but we are allowed to mourn and to grieve in these situations. David, also in this mourning, this lament, there's also a bit of a eulogy in some ways. David talks about their bravery and skill in battle. Verse 23, for example, and 24. Even in this last battle that David and Jonathan had fought valiantly and bravely, he thinks of Saul, who had brought, verse 24, to the daughters of Israel scarlet and luxury and gold, perhaps thinking of the relative peace and prosperity that Saul had brought. Maybe there's an aspect in which some of these compliments are more deserving of Jonathan, but yet David allows those to also be spoken of Saul, verse 23. Saul and Jonathan were beloved and pleasant in their lives. And that might be pushing it a little bit with some of the things of Saul, but here David's being gracious, isn't he? And generous towards him. But of course, perhaps the most, he tells the daughters of Israel to weep for Saul, verse 24. He weeps for Jonathan, verse 25. Jonathan was his greatest friend, And so he says to them, I'm distressed. You were so pleasant to me. Your love was more wonderful, surpassing the love of women. Some people, of course, have taken those verses to try and imply some homosexual development or anything like that, but there's nothing like that at all here in these words. When he says your love was greater than the love of women, it's about Jonathan. What was Jonathan like? Jonathan had made a covenant with David, which he'd kept. Jonathan had protected and defended David, even when he nearly got stabbed by his own dad. Jonathan had risked his life for David. Jonathan had come to David and said, I know you're going to be king after my father has come to an end. You will be king. I will be second to you. Jonathan was someone, his greatest friend, who'd had such steadfast loyalty to him. And David finishes verse 27. Oh, how the mighty have fallen and the weapons of war have perished. Again, there's that sad acknowledgement of the war, the suffering of death. Do we weep and mourn when we see tragic things happening in the news around the world? Do we just say, oh, how the mighty have fallen, the weapons of war have perished. This has only brought disaster and suffering. Do we mourn? The promised king mourns. Do we? David doesn't have all the answers. He doesn't know what exactly how God is going to turn things for good in the future. And so we see the same in Jesus, don't we? When the promised king, Jesus, comes, he has compassion on the crowds that are like sheep without a shepherd. He stands and he weeps at the grave of Lazarus. As we mentioned already, he grieves over Jerusalem, thinking about the coming judgment that's coming upon it. Do we mourn? Do we grieve for some of those situations we see around us? And lastly, then, just heading into the beginning of chapter 2, the promised king begins to reign. David is now given this king, the crown and this bracelet by this man, but it's not just up to him to stick it on his own head, is it? He asked the Lord. It happened after this, some time, a few days, maybe even more had passed. And David asked God. He wants to obey. He wants to know God's timing for this, not to jump the gun, not to bite off more than he could. He wants God to guide him. Shall I go up to the cities of Judah? And God says, yes, go up. David's got a next question. Well, where should I go? He wants to obey. He wants to be the king who's going to follow in God's path. And God says, go up to Hebron. So he does. He goes up to the land of Judah, Hebron, a town within it. Judah, of course, was the tribe that David came from. That's where he would find his strongest support and so on. So it kind of made sense. And he goes up there, him and his men and his wives and their families too. And verse 4, the men of Judah came and they anointed David king over the house of Judah. He's anointed king. That's his coronation, which has remarkably little glitz and glamour to it. Just the matter of fact, here it happened. The men of Judah came, probably the elders and leaders of the towns and things like that. And they anointed David. And perhaps from that moment he put on the crown. We don't know, it's not mentioned even here in that. What is it the next thing David does? He hears that the men of Jabesh Gilead were the ones who buried Saul. Again, that was told us in the last chapter of 1 Samuel. These were the men who had once been rescued by Saul, who now repay the favor and go and rescue Saul's body and bury him. And again, it's one of those things that turns the tables round a bit. If you didn't know David, you'd expect the opposite. You'd expect David to reward the Amalekite for bringing him the crown and news of Saul's death. And you expect David to be wary of the people who had been loyal to Saul, like these people had. But David turns those things completely upside down. He judges the man who claimed to kill the king. And these men who'd been loyal to Saul, he says to them, you're blessed of the Lord. You did a good thing. You showed kindness to King Saul. and may the Lord repay this kindness. The word he's using is steadfast love, covenant love. It's a big thing he's saying. May God show you covenant love because of your bravery in burying Saul. Now he says in verse 7, let your hands be strengthened, be valiant. They now live behind enemy lines, actually, in Jabesh Gilead. Now the Philistines have taken over that bit. He says, your master Saul is dead, but the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. He can say to these people living behind enemy lines, which are pretty bleak, if the Philistines found out they were the ones who buried Saul, they'd be in big trouble. But only David's found out so far. And David says to them, let your hands be strengthened, be valiant, be brave. Saul is dead, but I am king. He says to them, your hope needs to be in me, King David. I will make this right in the end. Last thing. This all happens. We've been calling him the promised king. And the link to that lies in one simple place where it's all happening. It all happens in Hebron. What God said, go up to the cities of Judah. Where shall I go? Go to Hebron, says God. Why Hebron? Have you heard of it before? You don't hear a lot of it after. But you do hear of it before now. Hebron was quite a historical place. It was the place in the book of Genesis where Abraham camped. Abraham went into the promised land when it was just a promise. Other people lived there. And he set up his tents by the Mamre trees in Hebron. And that keeps coming back lots of the times to the story of Abraham. Abraham camped there for a large number of years. God's promises were made to him when he was there in Hebron. Abraham was buried with Sarah, his wife, Isaac, their son, and Rebekah, his wife, Jacob, his son, and Leah, his wife. They were all buried in Hebron. David is told to go up there to the place of promise, the place where it all began. And there he goes. In Hebron, it was where God promised the whole land to Abraham. It's where God had made a covenant with Abraham. It's where God had told Sarah that she would have a son and even kings would come from her family. It's in Hebron that three strangers come, and one of them's the Lord. And they promise that Abraham will have a son, Isaac, within a year. It all happens in Hebron. And so David goes there because he's the promised king. He is the answer to lots of those promises, at least in a little way. And David goes up, and there in Hebron, the men of Judah anoint him king. Well, it's a bit of a small start. There's a few chapters until he becomes king of Israel. Spoiler alert. But it's a mustard seed. God's promises are starting to come true. Small and slowly, but surely, they're coming true. Promises are starting to be fulfilled in David. Of course, some of them would only ever be fully fulfilled in his son, Jesus. And so as the promised king begins, we're meant to keep coming back to those promises. Because the writers of the Bible never want to forget them. Keep coming back to those promises. When times are tough, perhaps when we are mourning and sad, perhaps when we do see injustice and difficulties all around us, the promised king still reigns. His promises are being fulfilled. King Jesus, who inherited the throne of David, who has the right to reign forever and ever. And so even in the very start of David's life as king, we see a hope that points forward to that reality for the Lord Jesus, the king who reigns, the king who mourns, the king who brings justice, but even more, the king who graciously brings salvation to. The one who could fulfill those promises of Abraham to bring blessing to the whole world, to all who would believe in him.